fear?
I don't have, I just have this, but what's it called? Can we post the other goods later? So really what I wanted to talk a little bit about tonight is the dimension of, you know, of the post-Pesach experience, not that type of post-Pesach, but post-Pesach also. The idea of what happens after Pesach, and really, to a certain extent, understand also on a psychological level, like, a little bit about the immensity of the experience of Pesach, and then what happens after. And I found the best, I was trying to figure out the best way to talk about this in psychological terms. A lot of times I have a psychological phenomenon down, and I spend a lot of the afternoon looking for, you know, for the piece of Torah that connects. This time I had the Torah, I was looking for the psychological phenomenon that was really what I want to talk about today. So, I mean, essentially, what goes down to so much, really, of our experience, what we're going to talk about is the idea of the fight or flight response, which we speak about a lot because so much of it like is interwoven into our experiences of just about everything, whether we're talking about, you know, like in us functioning in the daily life, whether we're talking about our interpersonal relationships, the person that Hashem will get married, that so much of what's happening oftentimes is this cycle of fight or flight activation between the two people. And sort of just like playing out between the two people. Somebody says something that activates that person, and then the person reacts to their activation. And then, you know, add stupidity, stir, and mix well. And we just get into it because immediately a fight or flight response is triggered. And you know, the resulting arguments emerge as they do. We all have different stress patterns, different reactions to stressors. They're, you know, normally comfortable neural pathways that have sort of been carved out inside of us. And understanding this in terms of science Chabot, and then we'll understand a little bit more in terms of you know, citizen machshava. About what we're talking about. So, famously, there's the fight or flight response. The fight or flight response is any time that a person is in danger, the master of the world, imbued within us the ability to react to danger, either to get away or to fight the danger off. We're given, one might even think to say, super abilities, if you would. Oftentimes, you know, they have on record people being able to run faster than they can imagine running in a track meet or down the block with their friends or playing tag or playing ball. Or they can move faster than they can. They can lift things larger than they can imagine. The body is capable of, you know, flows the body. Unbelievable, unbelievable things, because there's wellsprings of strength within us that we don't even know that we have. This is all part of this fight or flight response. The problem is oftentimes our fight or flight response gets triggered by things that fighting or flighting is not going to work. I have a test coming up. Fighting or flighting is not going to save me. I can't run away from the professor. They're going to put me in jail if I beat up the professor. So that's clearly not going to work. Right? The stressor is there, and fight or flight is not going to. It's not going to get me out of it. So oftentimes that turns inward. Our ability to draw on these reserves, is what we call the sympathetic or the sympathetic nervous system. And our ability to shut that down is called the parasympathetic. Parar in Spanish, if you remember, or para in Latin means to shut off, to stop. So what will happen oftentimes is that our bodies will go into this state. We don't even necessarily know that this is what's happening, but the rapid breathing, because we need to get oxygen, in a hurry. Our heart rate is increased because we gotta get blood to the extremities. We gotta get blood and oxygen to the parts of the body that gotta move. Our muscles will tense up because we're ready either to hit or to run. We'll have a loss of appetite because the body doesn't need at that moment to digest food or even hold food. I need to either run away or fight. My body holding food in my system so that I can draw the nutrients out, that's not on the menu for right now. So as a result, we're shutting all those systems down. Increased waste elimination. Again, because the body, they don't need it inside. I've just got to go. The increased sweat. I need to cool myself down. The pupils are dilated. Trying to be as efficient as I can in dealing with being able to look at what's going on. I don't need to see the whole scope of vision normally. I understand there's a danger, and I sort of only can see that. Now, all these different physiological changes kick in when I'm experiencing danger. Right? And part of this, it saves our life in many, many different moments, in many, many different ways. However, we get into problems when where it's being triggered in a time when we don't need it. Everything the body is doing, even mental health a lot of times, is that the body is trying to be adaptive. It just doesn't exactly know what to do, and it becomes maladaptive. Right answer, wrong question. As oftentimes you'll hear, all the midos are midos kadoshas. And all the midos, they're holy. It's just we have to refine them, figure out what's the right context. So what will happen oftentimes is that we'll start to perceive things as threats. We need to learn, how to shut our bodies down and to say, hey, this is not a threat, this is not a danger, right now this is okay. I've mentioned before when I was in the mindfulness program in University of Amherst, but it was Zoom, so I was there, but I wasn't there. But the Zoom University of Amherst Medical Center, John Kabat-Zinn, one of the people on the cutting edge of using mindfulness in a medical setting, so he established the first program there, and that's where I went to go do mindfulness. So one of the things they said is the first moments of response, that's automatic. What comes afterwards, that's you. We don't realize that it's us because we're just trained by experience that, okay, this is what's happening, this is how I feel. That's not how I'm going to react to those feelings. There are sensations in my body that I've learned mean certain things, and as a result, that's the way that I'm going to react to them. But when I can start to understand what I'm reacting to and what I'm feeling, fight. But then I become scared of feeling that way again. So I become afraid of being afraid. And this is the way a lot of the times anxiety goes. That anxiety will build on itself. That I'll be afraid of it being afraid. So being able to pay attention to what's going on and being able to make small, slight changes of how I'm reacting to things can benefit us in that long the long run over the course of my life. So if you look at the second page of the ones with my logo on it over here, page one as it were, I copied it. There's the URL in case you want to go to follow. There's so much great material just around on the internet. You can just link to it. My wife teaches teaches elementary English, and she said, I'd love to teach Judaics, but a lot of the times you have to make all the sheets yourself, and it's a lot easier. You have all these different huge amounts of resources at your fingertips that everyone's making these different teaching aids. It's so much easier. She taught Limudei Kaddish in Boca Raton, but you have to make everything from scratch, and there they have everything is at your fingertips. Also mental health, everything is at your fingertips a lot of times, because there are a lot of therapists out there, and a lot of therapists want to share their tools or share their take or sort of put it out there. So it's great little blurblet, I guess, because it's not huge, but there are three different skills, the mindful skills. The ability of mindfulness is the ability of us to pay attention, or as Kabat-Zinn would say, pay attention as if your life depended on it. Because so many times we sort of split our focus of what's happening, And we don't really even understand that we're distracting when we're distracting ourselves, because we're not aware of it, because we're used to doing it so often. We're used to not paying attention. I mean, we carry little distraction candy bars in our pockets all the time that take us out of the moment. But we all dissociate, and sometimes that's also adaptive. Like when you're driving on a long drive down the highway, you have to pay attention. But your brain, is sort of not using all of its energy paying attention, because staring at a highway endlessly for hours, that it's not doing that. So as you're driving, so sometimes you might not even feel that you're driving. You might just be driving, watching and making sure no deer jump in front of you or anything like that. It's a scary thing if anyone's ever had a deer jump in front of them. But start trying to pay attention a bit. But again, your mind that isn't like 100% there. Oftentimes, whatever it is that we're doing, we're not 100% there. We're listening, maybe we're not listening. We're not necessarily paying attention, because a lot of times our brain is also simulcasting. It's commentary as we're going, and the more commentary the brain starts giving to us, the more crowded our attention becomes. That's why sometimes when a person gets nervous about being in a social situation, I'm sitting here giving a share, I'm wondering what all the new guys think of me, and I'm like, hey, so, am I sounding okay? Does my voice sound a little nasal right now? Am I doing okay? Am I clear? And it's the brain, so even as I'm talking, the brain can start judging what's going on, and start appraising and judging and saying, hey, am I doing this right? So what happens is that if that part of my brain starts getting too loud, I'll lose my train of thought, because the commentating part of my brain is getting louder than the actual active part of my brain. So the part of our ability to be mindful then is to sort of draw our minds back into the moment, into just thinking about my message, thinking about what I'm trying to express over here, to what my experience is, as opposed to listening to the part of my mind, which is giving the running commentary on everything else which is there, because you understand that your brain is taking in much more information really than you can ever hope to really truly understand, analyze, discuss. And a lot of it just regulates to, okay, been there, done that, seen that. When we're mindful, we sort of draw our attention to parts of the experience that we haven't really heard about or thought about or never really investigated. Sometimes it's body sensations. Sometimes it's sounds in a room. Sometimes I would do this exercise with a bunch of my students in Brooklyn, and we'd sit there in the room, and then all of a sudden the air conditioner would sound like a train right next to you. It would be so loud. You normally didn't hear that, the air conditioner at all, but then all of a sudden when you're listening to it, it comes much, much louder, because it's just that part of my brain is not really analyzing the stimuli that are coming in. When I can draw my mind into thinking about what's happening right now, as opposed to listening to the commentator in my head, not the newspaper, the commentator that inside my head, the judging mind, and just experiencing what's happening, what's here right now, suddenly I'm right here, as opposed to thinking, well, what if I say the wrong thing? Then nobody's going to come back. Then it's just going to be me, Yosef, and Evan again eating pizza, eating three pies again. I'm going to have to tell Herschel that, oh no, we ordered too much pizza again. Your brain draws a whole script, a whole drama over there. You can fit, if you're used to your mind doing that, as you get to the classroom and you're running late, what am I going to tell the teacher or the rabbi why I was late? And you try to start telling the whole story in your brain. Well, could I tell him this? Would that be believable? Your brain starts to draw up a whole story, as opposed to just feeling the handle of the door, feeling your socks your socks on your toes and the soles of your shoes under your feet as you just walk in. And instead of listening to your brain saying, oh, maybe everyone's looking at me now that I'm walking in late, just just focus on the motions of sitting down. It changes the experience. When I'm listening to what's happening now, I don't have time to listen to or attention or focus the part of my brain which is listening to the judging mind, which is making me nervous, which is making me get into the whole fight or flight thing. Which is either worrying about the future or worrying about the past, which sometimes is depression, or is worrying about the future, which is anxiety. I don't have any time to start going into those other places because I'm too busy being here. That's why Dr. Benji's handle is Be Here Now. Be Here Now, 365. And be here, right? Because literally when I can bring my mind to this moment, then so much of the anxious thoughts that are oftentimes like following us around, they're not there anymore. Because I my brain is too focused on the now to think about it. So there's one terrific exercise of noticing your breathing. Now, there's a lot of fun stuff we can do with our breathing. Nobody really ever taught us to breathe or taught us how to think. They just assume because we do seem to do it by ourselves anyway, just not really train you in how it's done. Just like say, okay, yeah, you're here, you're thinking, you're breathing. So like, okay, so we're gonna let you keep doing that. But in truth is that learning how we breathe and learning what our breathing does can really change so much of our experience. For example, and this is not the exercise that they're talking about right now, but if you notice, if you take a very, very deep breath, big deep breath, we can all try it. You fill up your chest cavity full of air, you go, then you let out slowly. What you're actually doing is that you're telling your body, parasympathetic nervous system, there is no bear going to eat me right now. There's no need to breathe quickly, because the body starts feeling you breathing quickly, it starts triggering sympathetic nervous system again, and you start getting into it. But if you breathe slowly, you can literally tell your body to chill out. Take a deep breath. Let it out slowly. Savor the exhale. Inhale. And savor the exhale as it comes out. Draw it out. You just feel, you'll feel your heart just to start to slow down. You'll feel your brain start to stop racing, because those chemicals are like saying, oh, it's parasympathetic time. Oh, time to chill out now. The tension sort of leaves. So that's one way of doing it and chilling out. There's another way. It's just to focus on your breathing and just to get to know it. Just as you're sitting right here, like, what is your breathing like right now? No, don't force, just feel. Yeah, you feel the intake, the outtake. You're not forcing, you're not pushing air in or pushing air out. You're just noticing what's going on, noticing what the breath is like. Noticing the breath, noticing the in, noticing the out. Ever noticed? It's machaya when you take a deep breath, because you're not really filling your lungs up with oxygen. It's machaya. You ever thought that the word neshama comes from the word breath? And lin shof, breathe in, breathe out. The word ruach, another word for your neshama, it's also, it's air. That airway, that breath, the breath of life. Vayipach bi'apav nishmas chayim. That the understanding, recognizing breath as it's coming in and out, that's chiyus, it's levitic. Yes.
You know, the opposite of people like passing away when they sneezed, say when the air goes out.
Exactly, because it came unchained. That's right. That's all part of the same idea. That the ruach was no longer bound to the body. So, but noticing that, just noticing that's present brings you into the now. Brings you into noticing, as opposed to all the other thoughts that can be going all over the place. You're paying attention to how breathing is working. You know, even just paying attention to touching your arm, touching two arms, tapping. Part of an entire therapy program we spoke about in our previous episodes is about tapping, noticing the sensations on your arm. Because if you notice the sensations on your arm again, if I'm thinking and sensing what's going on over here, I'm not listening to the critic, I'm not listening to the commentator, it's very, very hard for me to be focusing on the sensation and saying, oh, you know, do I have any spinach club between my teeth? Like, right? So if I'm tapping on my arm because my brain is too busy listening to the tactile sensations. Yes.
It's related to the, I think it was the DBT thing you said, with the, like, waving the hand.
That's EMDR.
EMDR, and to, like, have your brain focusing on one thing, like, stimulating it, to say, like, focus on this now.
Right, so there is when you're holding a memory. You're holding a memory up, and you're trying to like, pass it between both sides of your brain. And you could pass it for both sides of the brain, left brain, right brain, left brain, right brain, left brain, right brain. And keeping it in the present, that way you don't see you don't like sink into the amygdala. When you sink into the amygdala, that's where trauma is stored. So the trauma is a living memory that doesn't like ever really go away. That the amygdala has no wristwatch. That's what I always say. The amygdala doesn't have a watch. It doesn't have a phone. It doesn't have a clock. So the amygdala sort of like the memories sort of live in there. Especially traumatic memories live in there. Where you get stuck on fight or flight. It's just like there. So if I can keep myself present now and look at the image that the brain can process. This is just trying to draw myself into the present now and just like sort of be here so I can say, oh, here I am. Here I am, right here. Just trying to pay attention to something around you. If you can hear the rush of the air conditioner right now, the blowing was up in first all day, and there's that jackhammer was mamish going all day. I feel like I have to go get some earplugs for tomorrow. This is like the quietest I've had for all day already. It's been like hammering, literally, and all of a sudden it's silent, and it's like, wow, that silence is great. And they stopped with the jackhammering. Even on the third floor of my office, as we still hear it, and then all of a sudden it stopped. It's just like, that's the sweetest non-sound that I've heard. It's like nothing. No. And then there seemed to be different tools, because there's a bassier one and a more treble one. I'm like, I feel like I'm going to start pounding on the radiator and now we'll start like a beat or something. It's an EDM, I don't know.
After 11, it sounded like someone was hammering the roof for like a solid 30 minutes.
Yeah, the same idea. It's just like crazy. Just noticing it. Like we've said before, drinking cold water, cold soda. We miss out on like as you eat the pizza, right? Taste the beginnings of the sauce, the cheese. You'll submerge. And normally, what happens is like we pound, right? We pound food. We don't like savor it because we're afraid there's not going to be another one left. So what happens is that if we draw our attention to the eating experience. They taste the sauce, and you get the good sauce where it's like a little juicy, the sauce, as opposed to being like dry, crusty. So like the juicy sauce and like the smooth cheese, like the cold, and cheese is cold. It sort of like starts to congeal, as opposed to a stretchy type of feeling. Or you'll eat sushi. Right? You eat sushi, and don't be like a pressed American and like dump sweet sauce all over it. Like, why'd you pay $30 for a roll and then cover it in sweet sauce? I'll just make some like plain rice. Just pour sweet sauce on it also. It's a lot cheaper. Take a piece of sushi. Each part of the sushi has a personality. That's why you have like on the top. You have like sometimes you'll have the fish or the avocado on the top of it, right? And then you'll have something inside. And then you'll have the rice. And the rice has a personality also. Each grain of rice can have a personality when you pay attention, right?
This is the first year you brought up the pizza thing, by the way. You've, like, changed how I eat pizza. I don't know if you know, like, the past few weeks, every time we have pizza here this year, I'm, like, taking 10 minutes a slice rather than that. Because I'm like, you know, you gotta taste
it. Yeah, it's an experience. We don't notice our food, like, to the extent that... You know, so we're always looking then for, like, intense flavors because we don't taste anything. We pay attention because the brain is already, so maybe it's listening to the podcast or the sheer or the like thinking about, you know, whatever else is coming next. A person that like comes and focuses in, like we just I don't know, maybe you made birkas ilanos already, maybe you didn't get there's another couple of days left. There are two apple trees in front of the base midrash. Learned with some of my guys, it's a piece of Rabbi Uzi Kalchai Malav Shalom. There's a Ram in Merkas HaRav. And the Gemara teaches us about Birkas Ilanos is very funny. It's not like, you know, normally you say, okay, well, you see a place where a miracle was done for Yisrael, or you hear thunder, or you hear lightning. The Gemara is oddly specific. A person who is Yotze, the Chodesh Nisan, the Roeh, Peros, Prachos HaIlan, right? It's Ilan HaPeros. You have to go see a fruit tree. You have to go out in Nisan, and then you go see a fruit tree. There's a deal in the postgame whether or not you have to actually go on a trip to go see the trees, or if you haven't just walk, it's enough. That make it, or you feel like it's a little bit of shalach khan, like, hey, do I have to go looking for this bird or not? So he says beautifully, the idea is the person goes out and they go out from the regular routine, and you break from the routine, that routine which normally takes me out of my focus. Because the routines, they're good. They're very good. They're very comforting routines. But at the same time, they also make you miss stuff. Because you're just used to your routine. So when you leave your routine, so Davke, you leave your house, and you go out in Nisan, and Nisan is the month where everything is new. Don't say, oh, this is just the natural cycle. And yeah, so of course trees are going to flower in the spring. This is the bracha is specifically telling you the opposite. The opposite, that despite the fact that you might think that it's the spring and things are going to renew, go out, get out of that sugar, get out of your normal order, and then say to Kadosh Baruch Hu, Shaloch Yiser Klum Be'olamo, nothing is missing. And you made Brios Tovos, the Ilanos Tovim, right? You made nice things, Lehenos B'nei Adam, we should have a geschmack from it. You made good stuff for us. If we don't recognize it, so we miss it. We get so wrapped up in the thoughts, so then we miss it. And we sort of like don't pay attention. We have to draw ourselves into this paying attention. So, I mean, that was pretty Hasidic as it was, but let's talk something a little bit even more Hasidic. Pesach night is the most immense night. It's tremendous. It's the most immense night. It's three in the ones with my heading. Pesach is the most immense night, the most majestic night. And the thing about Pesach is that afterwards, we sort of, it's all sort of gone. And the writings from Kedosh and B'nai Sascha talks about this also. I could have brought that too. I'm thinking about it. But this piece from Shem Shmuel was Kedai. I saw it once. It's a gorgeous Shem Shmuel. So Shem Shmuel comments on the fact that we read the Haftorah of Atzamos Yeveshos, the dry bones, right after Pesach. On Cholmoid, because for Gaonim and Mishum the Gabbal be Yadenu shabe Pesach yet Tchias Amesim, and Pesach is going to be Tchias Amesim. V'yesh Loimer. Well, let's explain another reason. Hine be Yom Echad shabe Pesach Yisigul Yisrael Ha'aros Gedolos L'mayla Kipi Madrigasam. But all of a sudden, we had a huge, tremendous experience, bigger than anything that we possibly could have imagined, bigger than our Madrega. Memela de Baochahaya or Gadol Shofealehem, Lo Hirgishu Mute Mahutam Kimuvan. That you were so caught up in the experience. For Haraya, you don't know at all what we're doing for most of the Seder. Okay, eat the matzah, okay, eat this lettuce, eat this matzah, how much matzah? I don't know. Then all of a sudden I'm singing ending counting and singing about a goat. I was like, what was that? Like, you wake up, it's sort of like four cups of wine in. What was that experience? Right? Like, at the end, we're singing about a goat, and we're counting down, and maybe you're singing an Uncle Moshe's song also, like, one is Hashem. And it felt like, I 100% felt like that was a holy experience. And now you look back, like, what just transpired over there? Like, what was that? Like, you were zonked out of your mind and you said Shir Shirim anyway. You're just like, what was that? What was all of that? Like, we broke into every tune for Hallel that we knew. On a given, like, Tuesday evening, we would not find ourselves doing that at all. And at that moment, we felt like that was this is where we have this is where we have to be. This is what's right, and this is the experience. Part of the Bashnak experience was different and interesting starting that took place this year. But at one point, all of my four kids are all teenagers, so that I don't even know what they were arguing about, but they were all very upset at each other at some point or another in the middle of the Seder about how this one was explaining that and that was explaining this, and they're no, it's not like this, it's not like that. They were like fighting that. I was like, I don't know what they're all talking about at this point, but it was very and then by the end, it was like all of a sudden they're all like singing together. I was like, when did this happen? And how did this happen? This is just the weirdest experience ever, right? After three cups in, already everybody's willing to sing Nishmas together. Like, I don't know if you didn't have that experience. Maybe you did have the experience, but it was just wild. And then everyone's like, and then there's those two, V'amartem Zevach Pesach, right? Nobody has a tune for that. You just sort of like fit in Atatakum or something. You know, try to fit it in, like, or Shomer Mafkid, Kol Hayom V'Kol Halayla. So you try to force that one totally into that first one. Forget the chorus of it, but you know the one I'm talking about. It's right after Chasal, and then before Adyahu, Adyahu, we have at least two or three tunes for, or Achad Miyadea we have, and Chag Gadya we have. There's like two ones, the one that you say on the first night, one you say on the second night. That's the second one. The first one. Vayhi b'chatzi alayla. There we go. Vayhi b'chatzi alayla. B'kiyas. So because the Shomrim Hafkid L'Yircha was written to the last stanza of the song, right at the very end of it. So you can cram it in because it's about got the meter. You can about cram it in. We'll tune for those. And then you see Chag Gadya. Like, what was that? And the next morning, like, what just happened? And sometimes also, if you're in America, like, oh, we have to do that again? How am I going to do that again? But then if, by the end of, again, three cups in, and again, it just feels fine singing Hallel, and what's it called? All the Kilom Chastos and Nishmas, it just feels right. Because it's outside of our Madrega. Like, no matter what you prepared yourself for, even if you composed like your own Haggadah and wrote lots of notes in the columns and everything, it's still like, what happened on Seder night we were not prepared for, and it wasn't really, within our kelim to absorb. And then we didn't feel anything of ourselves. But however, afterwards, that great illumination left, and we were left in our regular mode of thinking. So that what happened is that we look at last. Well, last night was lepidic. How do they say? The kids say nowadays that was fire. Right, that was fire. That was fire. Now, like, it's some gefilte fish and cognac, and that's a cult in the second day, lunchtime second day. But last night, that was something. Now I feel like dry. I feel like dry bones or dry matzah at least. That in the future there's going to be a kibbutz galios, and then Hashem will clean us from all of our avonos, because so long that we're in the galus, we don't even feel like that we're so off. But then, after a little bit of light, then we understand what was going on. וכן כסף שבמצרים שבאות במצרים, אף שהיו במם תשאר יתום הכל דרך איש ישר בעיניו, רק ששייצו ותמו רובה ביום ראשון איזה אור כי טוב, אחר כך ניתנו מהם נשפר ליבם וקירבם והיו בעצמם כאילו היו. So it's only afterwards, right? They didn't even feel that they were on Mem Tesh Shari Tuma. They didn't even know that they were on such a, as it were, a low madrega, as they would say. They didn't even notice. They had no hasaga. It was only the day afterwards, like the morning after, like, oh man, really? Wow. I didn't know that. And then they felt like a Tamas Yavashis. They felt like dry bones. It dried out. Shekfar haya b'hem lefnei zman kabir ruach who kabbalas ha'avos ha'gadoshim arvim yitzchak v'yakov v'yatzmehem ruach machmas tumas ha'gals al ken hevinu shem mechuyavim laschem b'sfira. So then at that point when they realized that they were that what they experienced now where they were, they realized, man, we gotta count sfira. The idea of sfira is to try to recapture that light that we had on Seder night. Lashuv b'mal samar rishona b'matan Torah liyos sod Hashem alai. The entire idea was for them to return to that place, to that experience, you know, that tremendous experience that I had on the first night. We reach it, we own it on Shavuos. So what's fantastic also is the idea is this immensity of experience. It's huge, it's too much. And because it's too big, we don't have the kelim, we don't have the ability to really integrate it. There's the word, integrate it with ourselves. So it's gone. Just in the same way in our daily lives, the immensity of experience oftentimes brings us to the place of fight or flight. Without our ability to claw ourselves back to the senses, right? We don't have the kelim. Literally, we say, I don't have the kelim for this. Some people say, I don't have the kelim for this. It's just too much. It's overwhelming. Whatever is overwhelming, so what do? You come to any experience, this is too big, it's too much, I'm never going to be able to do this. And once I start saying, I'm never going to be able to do this, I start getting into that, you know, that judgy mind. I start getting into that idea of anxiety of the future, concern that I'm never going to be able to do this. I've left the present, and now I'm in that netherworld of anxious futures. And what do? I bring myself back. I bring myself back into Kalim. Bring myself into bite-sized chunks. Into these little bite-sized chunks, and then I can deal with it, and I can cope with it. And in our minds, we always forget that life is never just the sum of the parts. It's much, much bigger. Now, only ever when we take things step by step. I'm going to share with you a fantastic maral. Not stam maral, fantastic maral. Maral's in Rosh Chodesh. That's the maral Sefer Purim. And I'm sure you might remember that terrific day when Mordechai was called by Achashverosh through Haman to go and be taken through the streets of Kacha Yeisa Leish Asher Mel Chofetz Bikara. This is what should be done for somebody who the king wants to honor. Right? This is what should be done. So Haman's job is to take Mordechai through the streets. Can't find Mordechai. Where's Mordechai? Mordechai, the Gemara says, is teaching teaching in yeshiva. He's teaching the Beis Darziki. He's teaching the children. He's teaching the rabbis. Different gersos. And they find him. And what's he doing? He's teaching them, according to one of the gersos of Gemara, he's teaching about the Korban HaOmer. It's kind of random, right? Pretty random. Like saying, he found them on Shavuos morning and he was teaching about cheesecake. Oh, why cheesecake? Why the Chazal have to tell us that he's teaching them about Korban HaOmer? So, a little bit of a framing. If you look carefully, you'll see that despite the fact that the war with Haman and Amalek and all the action in Shushan was taking place in Adar, the decree took place in Nisan. And the davening took place the day before Pesach, the second day of Pesach. They didn't eat matzah that year because they were fasting. Or Simon quoted, I think, the Hesoros Tshuva, that maybe it was only a day fast, so at night they ate matzah. Or maybe they only ate a kezias, but which was smaller than a ta'ena, so or a mali lugma, so it was fine to eat the matzah on Pesach night. Or maybe it was a fast derabanan and the nechila deraisa. So, but different ideas. But regardless, they were fasting at that time. So it's the first day of Pesach. Haman finds Mordechai teaching them about the Korban Omer. And he says to Haman, yeah, if we would have a Beis HaMikdash, then we would be bringing this Korban right now, this Korban HaOmer. And Haman says, oh, looks like you are barley. So the discussion goes on. Oh, how many hundred gold coins is it? And Mordechai says, no, it's a handful of barley. A handful of barley? Your handful of barley just pushed away my 10,000 pieces of silver. 10,000 pieces of silver out the window, deflected by a handful of toasted barley. Not bad. So Maral says, what is that? He says, Pirush de davar hu davar muflug v'amok. That this thing, this matter, is fantastic and incredibly deep. Ki davar hazeh v'hanes hazeh hay bezman shelo hayu nisim v'niflos ba'olam. El'om hayanahu kimin haga. He said that this was, so we have to understand what's happening. The specific miracle that took place, the events of the Megillah, as well as the Korban which is being brought, the effect of the Korban which is being brought, and the plot line, they all collide together. When there's a Chazal like this, Maral is telling us a fantastic rule for a Chazal that is all part of a set. It's all symmetrical. The Omer is a demonstration of an expression of the same thing of the miracle of Purim. It's the same idea, he says. Because there were no Nisim at that time. And still, the mitzvahs of Omer stood for them. Ki Omer mevin HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'shul shuhu So he says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in the same way that the miracle of the Megillah happened in an incredibly natural way. It just looked like everything is just normal things happening. It's just normal that a king gets upset with a queen and has her killed off and gets a replacement. And it's just normal that somebody, you know, all the intrigue of a Persian court, that the king gets some people upset and then they try to kill him. And it's just normal that someone happens to overhear that the assassination plot and informs the king. And it just so happens that the king forgets conveniently to reward him until the time is right. And it just so happens that there's a genocidal maniac going on over there and trying to kill off of people. And it just so happens that he happened to be there at the wrong time when he was thinking to try to kill one guy, and that same guy is the guy who has to now march through the streets. It just so happened. Nothing so fantastically fantastic happened. Could have happened to you or me. In fact, these type of things do happen to you or me. I got an internship at a clinic because I had a friend who went and dropped my resume on the top of the pile so that when the director came in, they saw my resume on the thing and they gave me a call. It just happened like that. These things happen. Oh, the same way that these things do happen, but they don't just happen. Similarly, the Korban Omer is the same type of idea. The Korban Omer is all these different steps to take to to make the Korban Omer. You seed it, you put it in the ground, you harvest it, you bring it to the four corners of the world, you shake it around like a lulav. That's a tenufa. You shake it around like a lulav. As Hashem is truly interacting with us in these natural ways. So Rabbi Pinchas says, Marachos Rabbi Pinchas on now for Rabbi Pinchas, Benoig Shaba Olam Mechabis Ksuso Beyamos Agishamim. Kama Yehios Yaga Acho Lo Nonagava Vabrios Yeshenim Amitosam, the Kashbarchuma Motse Mat Ruach, Menagev Hesa Arts, the Tira Kimitsis Omer Rishul Shu Yisbarach, Manhiga Tapa Meshi Vruach, Megadal Tsimachem, Lefichach, Havasa Omer Himinashirim Dafka, Kietebu Huchomri. So this is the same way that God runs the world. A person goes, lies down and goes to sleep. And Hashem goes and makes all the world working in the background, like a, you know, like any app that you have running in the background. You open the computer and you're playing a sound file at the same time you're typing up your paper. There's nothing playing going on in the background. Kadosh Baruch Hu is making it all happen in the background. The Omer is a very, very specific. That's why it's called the Omer. It's a shear. It's a small amount. How Kadosh Baruch Hu is making even these little things moving around in the background. I don't even know how it's happening, but it's all happening that same way. The Omer is the same action as the story of the Megillah. All the action interacting. It's all happening. Everything with an incredible amount of dikduk. Everything with incredible amounts of precision. Even at a time when there's no nisim and no niflos, but Hashem Baruch Hu makes these nisim and niflos even in a way of teva, even in a way, and he says, and that's what it means, Shem Adnus. When we say, even though we don't say the name Yud K Vav K, we say God is the master. Every time we see God's name, we say you're the master, even though it means he's all reality. He's everything. He is, he was, he will be. He, all of reality is under his control. He's the master. And that's it. And that's why we just say that he's the master. And that's why that the merit of the Omer that they want. You understand, by the way, the Maral is dissecting every word of the Gemara. And so it's not just that the Omer appears in the Sagadata and Purim appears in the Sagadata, but it's also the Omer is that which brings us to Matan Torah. And Haman was looking specifically to make a tree 50 Amos, right? Like the 50th day of Sfiras Omer, I believe it's the Midrash writes it, that he's trying to undermine Matan Torah, which happened is the Tree of Life on the 50th day. Tree, get it? Tree, life, 50 days. The whole idea is over there. And specifically the Omer, which is what brings us to Matan Torah, which allows us to grow to that Madrega, bit by bit, step by step, in Shiurim, and in a way that we don't even feel it, we don't even understand it. It's a fantastically beautiful Maram. And, you know, then we turn it on it, on its head to focus on us. There's several pieces in the Beis Yaakov's Haggadah and Ishbitz, but I figured I didn't want to give you like a doctoral dissertation over here. That several pieces from Beis Yaakov and Ishbitz that explain that this is how what Sfiras Omer is also. We don't understand or feel how each one of these days then adds up to Matan Torah. Each one of these days adds up to that Madrega of the Seder. We just know one after the other, after the other, after the other brings us to Shavuos. One after the other after the other. Not an immense overpowering experience to get us there. We see what happens with immense overpowering experiences. We don't know what's going on and we shut down. Lahavdil, but also not Lahavdil, but also Lahavdil. We talk about an overwhelming stimuli, the fight or flight syndrome. It's too big, it's too much. What do? We need to center, bring ourselves to small, to shiurim, to tzibislach. Hey, if I go and tell you, you know what? You need to write for me a 30-page paper. In 4 weeks. I say, my God, I can't do that. So, but they say, okay, you know what? Here's what I'm going to do. This week I'm going to decide a topic. Right? And then over the course of the next week, I'm going to start to get all the research into place. And then the next week over there, I'm going to start working on it. All of a sudden, this becomes shiurim, that it, the task which seemed so immense is now broken up into little pieces. and you don't feel it as larger as much. It becomes less overwhelming because I look at it bit by bit by bit by bit by bit. If I deal with what's in front of me, right, so then the anxiety over not being able to do it, or the depression about feeling like I've wasted my time, it lets go of me because I have what's in front of me right now. This is the idea of doing things b'shiurim, in small amounts, so bislach, bit by bit by bit. This is part of that, what I believe is what lies behind the you know, the idea of the Omer, the idea of the Shem and Shmuel that we brought up, that a person feels all dried out. How can I ever do that? How can I get back that like unbelievable Pesach night experience? The answer is no. What do we do? Bit by bit by bit, foot one foot after the other. My job is not to have an idea what the big picture is. I don't have to worry how am I going to get to the big picture. My job is to be on target for today, in the next moment. Part of what they say in the 12 steps. I was thinking about that being our introduction to the 12 steps. That same idea. It's all about, you know, for now. Person says, how can a person maintain sobriety?
One day at a time.
Exactly. Exactly. How I'm going to be sober for the rest of my life? I can't think of the rest of my life. I can think about tomorrow. I can think about the next hour. Think about the next 10 minutes. Any task, you bring it as an omer, as a handful of barleys. A handful of barleys. And Haman says, your handful of barleys pushed away my grandiosity, my 10,000 shekel of silver. Your handful of barleys totally, totally dismissed this overwhelmingness. He comes with 10,000 shekel of silver. That's overwhelming. That's too big. A handful of barley says, ah, you do this with dafka, specifically a handful. It's a bislach, as they say in Yiddish. A handful, little bit by bit by bit. This year, just an omer. And that's it. There's 49 different pieces, 49 different steps, 49 different days.